Chapter 24. Female Murderers. The psychology of women who kill is one of the most fascinating subjects in the whole field of criminology, for on the whole, women are not inclined to crimes of violence. At present, women form a negligible percentage of all criminals, well under 10%. It is true that crimes of violence among adolescent girls, mostly from slum areas, more than doubled in the first 3 years of the 1970s, but there's no sign of a general rise. And in spite of overcrowding in the big cities, which always produces a rise in the crime rate, it seems unlikely that female crime will ever become a serious social problem. The reason is obvious. Woman's basic instinct is for a home and security, and someone who values security will think twice about doing anything to jeopardise it. Man, with his more restless desires, his wider sense of purpose, is more likely to take risks, including crime. What about the women who do commit crimes, particularly the most serious crime of all, murder? The first noticeable thing in considering a cross-section of such women is that so many of them are sexually unattractive, often downright ugly. There are cases of pretty criminals, Marie de Brinvilliers, Ruth Ellis, Sharon Kinn, but they are rarities. Most murderesses are physically unattractive, highly dominant, and highly sexed. And this immediately explains why they take to crime. For all crime springs out of frustration, from the drunken husband who batters the baby to the company director who embezzles millions. A dominant woman may be very happy if she can find an even more dominant male to live with, as the researches of Abraham Maslow showed, but highly dominant women find it very difficult to find the right male. It is literally a chance in a million. If she's beautiful, she may continue to search and experiment until she finds Mr. Right. If she's ugly or middle-aged, or both, her chances are minimal. She may then express her resentment against society through crime. This pattern is visible in the careers of most female poisoners. Mrs. Merrifield, Nurse Waddingham, Nanny Doss, Mrs. Major were all dominant and unattractive. Psychologists have suggested that administering poison may even have been a kind of sexual substitute to these women, but this point is difficult to verify. For example, how can anyone fully understand the motives of Rhonda Bell Martin, the waitress of Montgomery, Alabama, whose career of crime extended over 3 decades? In 1970, doctors were puzzled by the illness that had paralysed Ronald Martin from the waist downwards. Extensive tests at the Veterans Hospital, Biloxi, Mississippi, revealed that the trouble was arsenic poisoning. His wife, Rhonda Bell, was several years his senior and had been at one time his stepmother. Rhonda had been married to his father, Claude Martin, who had died in 1951 with symptoms that resembled his son's. Claude's body was exhumed and found to be full of arsenic. The police now became suspicious of a number of deaths that had occurred in Rhonda's family circle, starting in 1934, when her 4-year-old daughter had died. Her first husband, George Garrett, died in 1937. 4 more children subsequently died, and her mother died in 1944. Confronted with the evidence, Rhonda Bell confessed that she had poisoned them all with ant poison, bought at the local grocery store. Her career bears remarkable resemblance to that of her fellow countrywoman, Nanny Doss. But this doesn't help us to understand why either of them poisoned husbands, children, and relatives. Many women who kill do so out of a brutality which is due to a harsh and difficult background. In 1969, tipped off by an anonymous letter, gendarmes in the little French village of Pierre-les-Nimeurs called at the home of André Lièvre and his 41-year-old wife Yvette. They had 5 children, but in the garden police found the corpses of 7 newborn babies. The Lièvres had decided that they could afford no more children after number 5, but they were too lazy or ignorant to investigate the possibilities of birth control. So, after each baby was born, it was drowned in the bath like a kitten, after which the husband buried it in the garden. A photograph of the couple shows them as stocky peasant types. Even more characteristic of this type of casual murder is a case that came to light in Hungary in 1929. A medical student from Budapest, walking along the banks of the river Tisza, near the village of Nozsrev, discovered the corpse of a man that had been washed ashore. A brief examination convinced him that the man had not drowned, but had been dead when thrown into the water. An autopsy revealed that the man had been poisoned. The police now began to investigate the nearby villages of Nongserev and Tizekert, and heard rumours that many more mysterious deaths had taken place. As a result of these rumours, the bodies of two men, Joseph Nororos and Michael Szabo, were exhumed. Both were found to have died of arsenic poisoning. The men had been nursed during their final illness by two local midwives, Suzanne Ola, who became known as the White Witch of Nogrev, and Frau Fazekas, both widows. These women were arrested, so were some women who were rumoured to have been their clients. One of these latter confessed to having bought arsenic from Frau Fazekas to poison her husband, his brother, and another man. The police began to suspect that they were dealing with mass murder on an unprecedented scale. Frau Fazekas proved to be hard, cunning, and immovable. After hours of questioning, the police allowed her to go. She fell into their trap, immediately rushing around to various clients, warning them to be on their guard. When the police called on her later, and she realised what she had done, she seized a cup of poisoned water and drank it. She died a few hours later. The police worked on Susie Ola and on the other clients of Frau Fazekas, and one old woman, Juliana Lipka, confessed that she had killed seven people in the past 20 years. The first had been her brutal and drunken husband, who had enraged her by selling some of their land to pay off debts. This embittered her grasping peasant soul. She took immense pleasure in watching his agonies as he died slowly from the arsenic that had been soaked out of flypapers. As the case dragged on, woman after woman confessed to murder, more than 50 of them. The story was incredible and sordid. Susie Ola was a witch, and those who availed themselves of her arsenic to get rid of unwanted husbands or children believed that her charms would ensure immunity from the law. A whole community of peasant women had allowed murder and witchcraft to become a way of life. Life in these primitive villages on the great Hungarian plain was harsh and dull. Hatred came easily. Dozens and dozens of victims were exhumed. The trial of the Angel Makers, the name given to them by the Hungarian press, was probably the biggest peacetime murder trial on record, from the point of view of the number of defendants and of victims. Many of the women, mostly those responsible for manufacturing and selling the poison, were sentenced to death, others to various terms of imprisonment. And yet, strangely enough, the case has now been largely forgotten, even in Hungary. It's even conceivable that murder may be hereditary, or at least the tendency to violence that leads to murder. In January 1956, 20-year-old Herbie Ferris died in the electric chair at Oklahoma State Prison for the murder of Detective Benny Cravat, whom he had shot in the course of a robbery. Ferris's mother was brought from a Texas jail to see her son before his execution. She was serving a term for the murder of her fourth husband. She had killed the previous two as well during the course of quarrels, so the verdict was of second-degree murder. Ferris's brother was serving a 10-year term for burglary. His uncle, Ray Hamilton, a close associate of Bonnie and Clyde, had died in the electric chair in 1934. It's arguable that this is a case of bad environment rather than heredity. Ferris commented that he had been in death row longer than I've ever stayed in any one place before. But he certainly had courage. When asked if he had anything to say before being strapped into the chair, he tapped his foot rhythmically, saying, "What is there to say, Daddy-O? Let's get on with it." Would Ferris have killed if he had not become accustomed to violence in his home life? It's doubtful. True female criminals, that is to say, women who choose crime as a career, are rare but not unknown. The name of Anna Hofner would certainly be better known to students if her trial had not occurred in the middle of the Nazi period, when German newspapers were encouraged to devote their space to other things than crime. When an elderly shoemaker named Wilhelm Hain was found stabbed and shot to death in his Dortmund basement, police found one interesting clue at the scene of the crime: a few strands of long auburn hair. Hain had been shot by a type of revolver issued to stormtroopers and police. This was embarrassing. In 1938, no policeman was anxious to be forced to arrest young Nazis, particularly if the affair turned out to have homosexual overtones. But criminal commissar Manus's investigations soon revealed another possibility. Although Wilhelm Hain was unknown to the Dortmund police, he was well known to a certain section of the underworld as a fence, a receiver of stolen goods. There were a number of fingerprints in the bedroom, but none of them was known to the police, and this suggested that if these prints belonged to Hain's clients, they were too young to have police records. An interesting picture was beginning to emerge: a gang of young men and a red-headed woman. Manus heard rumours from the Dortmund underworld of such a gang, but could find no further information. However, he ordered his men to keep watch for a young redhead hanging around the haunts of known criminals. And one day, a constable noticed a young and pretty redhead waiting outside a cinema. She looked nervous. The policeman watched unobtrusively from the shadows, perhaps having nothing better to do. He saw a young man pass the girl and go into the cinema. A few moments later, the girl also bought a ticket and went in. This was definitely suspicious. If she was simply out for the evening, why didn't she go in sooner? The officer rang headquarters, and a plainclothes man came to relieve him. When the cinema emptied and the red-headed girl and the young man came out together, they were followed to a cafe, where they were joined by two other young men. Later, the redhead and her escort went to an address in a residential area. The man came out alone, carrying a briefcase. Then he realised he was being followed and ran, hurling the briefcase over a wall. The detective retrieved it. It contained a piece of stolen gold plate, whose description had been circulated to the police earlier. A check on the woman's apartment revealed that her name was Anna Hoffner. But she had disappeared. However, the police had more luck in tracing the origin of the briefcase. They not only found the shop where it had been sold, to a young man who answered the description of their fugitive, but the shopkeeper also recalled that he had sold the same man a sharp stiletto, of the type that had been used to stab the shoemaker. He described the man as having bushy hair and a red tie. Sometime later, the police were called to a bar, where a drunken young man was brandishing a knife. He wore a bright green tie. He was arrested and taken to the cells to sleep it off, and then questioned about the death of the shoemaker. Eventually, the youth confessed. The beautiful Anna was the leader of the gang. He had been her lover, but now she had another. Hayne had been killed because Anna discovered that he had been cheating the gang. The suspect mentioned the name of another gang member, Hans Greil, who was located and followed. That night, in a restaurant, he was joined by the red-headed girl. Both were arrested. The final irony of the case was that Hans Greil was the son of the district chief of police and had used his father's gun to kill the shoemaker. The chief of police resigned, although he was in no way to blame. The members of the gang were not executed, they were underage. Instead, all were sentenced to long terms in prison. Unfortunately, no further details of Anna Hoffner's remarkable criminal career are available. Anna maintained her leadership of the gang by distributing sexual favours. The same is true of Marta Romero, arrested in Mexico in 1972. The police of Mexico City had many complaints from men who had been robbed in their apartments by a gang consisting of three young men and a young woman. The girl was clearly the leader, but her dark eyes seemed to be glazed with drugs. Then, one evening, police heard that a robbery was taking place in the vestibule of an apartment building. They moved quickly and found three young men and a girl, who was armed with a .38 revolver. The robbers surrendered quietly. All were under the influence of drugs. The men were two brothers named Gonzalez and a youth called Gutierrez. They protested that they disliked the idea of crime anyway, but Marta, who was the mistress of all three and slept with them in the same bed, threatened to withdraw their sex unless they took part in the robberies. Most of these robberies brought in fairly small sums of money, at most a few hundred dollars, as well as TV sets and similar booty. Their aim was to get money to buy drugs. Marta admitted that she had taken to petty crime at an early age. Her father had abandoned her after the death of her mother. Since then, her life had been a continuous pattern of robbery, drugs and sex. She appeared to be a nymphomaniac. This is consistent with Maslow's finding that highly dominant women tend to be promiscuous. The gang were all imprisoned. Women who plan murders carefully for gain are mostly the product of the crime writer's imagination. They seldom appear in real courtrooms. Sharon Kiner is an interesting exception, and her case is certainly fantastic enough to be pure invention. On March the 19th, 1960, a policeman was called to the home of James A. Kiner, an electronics engineer who lived between Kansas City and Independence, Missouri. He found James Kiner dead on the bed, shot in the back of the head. His pretty 19-year-old wife, Sharon, was in hysterics. Their 2-year-old daughter looked puzzled and frightened. When police finally managed to get a statement out of Sharon, it was to the effect that the child had gone into the bedroom with her husband's revolver and somehow shot her sleeping father. Tests on the gun indicated that it could be true, and friends testified that the child had been known to play with the gun. A coroner decided that James Kiner's death was an accident, and the pretty widow received a large insurance payment, part of which she spent on a Ford Thunderbird. The salesman was a handsome young man named Jones. He introduced Sharon to his wife, Patricia. Sharon found him very attractive. On May the 26th, 1960, Patricia failed to return home from work. Two members of her carpool, who had dropped her off, mentioned that she had climbed into a Ford Thunderbird with a brown-haired woman. The following evening, Sharon, out on a date with a young man, suggested that they might look around motels and bars for the missing Patricia. At 11:30 that night, as they drove down a lover's lane in Jackson County, they saw a body in the headlights. It was the missing Patricia Jones. Police discovered that she had been shot four times with a .22. When police discovered the chain of coincidences, that the victim's husband had sold the Thunderbird to Sharon Kiner, that Patricia had last been seen getting into a Thunderbird, that Sharon had found the body, they were more than intrigued, and Sharon was arrested. When they also discovered that she owned a .22 revolver, it began to look as if they had a strong case, except that they were unable to find the weapon. Nevertheless, she went on trial. Things looked black, and then an odd incident saved her. The previous owner of the .22 was traced. He had traded the gun in for another. He remembered firing bullets from it into a certain tree. The bullets were dug out and tested. They were not from the .22 that had killed Patricia Jones. The witness admitted he could have made a mistake. He owned several guns. But Sharon was acquitted. She was promptly put on trial again, this time for the murder of her husband. And when one witness testified that Sharon had offered him $1,000 to murder her husband, the case suddenly went against her. She was found guilty of murder. But in prison she continued to insist on her innocence. 14 months later, the verdict was quashed, and she was put on trial once again. On a technicality connected with a juror, the judge stopped the trial. Sharon's fourth trial began. The jury disagreed, and Sharon remained free. At which point she made the mistake of deciding to go to Mexico. In a bar in Mexico City, on September the 18th, 1964, she met a middle-aged man named Francisco Ordonez and allowed him to accompany her back to her hotel room. Not long after, there were shots. The hotel owner rushed to investigate and saw Sharon emerge from the room, gun in hand. When the owner tried to stop her, she shot him. He was still struggling with her when the police arrived, and the .22 revolver in her hand proved to be the one that had killed Patricia Jones. However, Sharon had already stood trial for that murder and couldn't be tried again under the rule of double jeopardy. But she could be tried for killing Ordonez, who, she said, had accompanied her to her room because she felt unwell. She'd been drinking heavily. Then he'd tried to rape her. In October 1965, a judge declined to accept that the crime had been in defence of her honour and sentenced her to 10 years in jail. She appealed, and the court decided that 10 years was not enough and added another 3. She should have left well alone.